yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Freddie Zolliott. Excuse me, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Well, we have a special topic today, as the radio station has been indicating with promos during the week. And we have some special guests, which I'm going to introduce shortly. Right? And the topic is it time for a third party in America? Why has the Democratic Party continued to fail to win and deliver for the rest of us? Might be a good subtitle. Or, wait a minute, maybe I should check that. Maybe it's time for a second party, not a third party, because what we have today are two wings of a single party that I like to call Corporate Party of America, a.k.a. the Republicans and the Democrats. What we're seeing today in recent years, at least since 2000, is a shift, a new trajectory for these two wings of the corporate party of America. They're undergoing, both of them, some fundamental transformations. On the one hand, let's take the Republicans. They're morphing into a party controlled by the radical right. Since Trump has come in, clearly, it's been purging itself of any moderates that are dropping like flies, leaving their positions in government, right? Linking up with the radical right at the grassroots, not just Breitbart and Bannon, but even neo-Nazis and racists who call themselves nationalists as a cover. It's reforming itself in the image of Donald Trump. Purging government bureaucrats, attacking the media, stacking the courts, not only at the level of the Supreme Court, but right on down. You know, below the radar is a shifty move going on, stacking now the federal district and appeals courts. And it's a party increasingly financed by right-wing finance capitalists, people like the families like the Mercers, the Adelsons, the Singers, and so forth. And then we have the Democratic Party, run by corporate CEO and lobbyists, squashing any attempts to reform it from Sanders and post-Sanders, purging its traditional program of working class demands, replacing it with identity politics, and a party quickly caving in on every opportunity it has to its opposition in Congress. We saw that with Gore in 2000, allowing Bush to steal the election. We saw it again with Kerry and tampering with the votes in Ohio and places, and Kerry throws it in the towel real quick, right? We see it with Obama for 8 years trying to extend bipartisanship, and every time he did, the Republican dog bit his hand. It's a party that's becoming strategically inept and tactically bankrupt. We saw it earlier this year with the Dreamers. Remember, the Democrats are going to draw a line in the sand on the budget. You know, if you don't pass the Dreamers bill, well, they turned and walked away from that. Then they're wondering why the polls show that Latinos aren't that excited about them anymore. We saw how they caved in on Kavanaugh. And now, behind the scenes, they struck a deal with McConnell not to push district and appeals courts judges so that they could run off and campaign. And what did McConnell do as soon as they ran away? Did exactly what he said he wouldn't do, right? They've lost all the states' legislatures between the two coasts. They're becoming inept, they can't deliver anymore. Therefore, the questions, are we at a critical juncture as both wings move further right? Are we at a juncture for a new second progressive party? Will it come from below in time? When will we see a founding convention of real grassroots political leaders, which has to happen before such a party can occur? And can it break itself from the single issueism and identity politics that are the bane of progressive politics in this country, as I've been saying over and over? And finally, how will labor, official union labor, support this? Will the AFL-CIO leaders still connected at the hip to the Democratic Party leadership actually break in more than just words? Well, these are all critical questions. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And I have two very special guests here. One is Nick Branagh. Let me say a little bit about Nick's bio before we jump into the show. Nick is a founder and national director of the Movement for a People's Party today, which has 50,000 supporters, members. It's a coalition of labor and progressive groups. Formerly, Nick was national coordinator for the Sanders campaign, a national coordinator who was responsible for liaison with the Democratic Party's superdelegates. Remember the superdelegates, you know, that emergency tactic that the Democrats used to prevent Sanders? Yeah, maybe he'll talk about the convention where the Democrats, recent convention of the Democratic Party, where they were declaring, oh, we've made concessions on the superdelegates. And Nick was also a founding member of Our Revolution, which was the Sanders and progressive labor movement, you might say, that flowed out of the 2016 elections. And before that, he was deeply involved with the Democratic Party, now breaking from it, as deputy director for various campaigns for Governor McAuliffe in Virginia and for others as well. John Kerry, I believe. Okay, so that's Nick Branagh, a very special guest who can tell us what's going on from the inside, has gone on, is going on, and why he feels there's no hope to reform a party in which its national committee, over 100 members, I think, are corporate lobbyists. That's why they like identity politics. You see, they don't have to really talk or deliver on the real issues. And then we have a guest we've had here before, a very special labor guest, deeply involved in the Latino community, Alan Benjamin. Alan was a delegate, a member of the Office of Professional Employees and a delegate to San Francisco Labor Council for many years, very much involved in California labor politics, and also just as deeply, if not more so, involved in Latino politics, both in the U.S. and globally here. And we have him back on the show here today to participate in this discussion, and in particular bring us a labor perspective here to the possibility of a third, a.k.a. second party. Okay, I've had my say. I'm going to allow my guests to jump into this and tell us, their view here. Let's start with you, Nick. What do you think of all these billionaires and these two wings of the Democratic Republican Party, of the Corporate Party of America? And it seems like they got two parties now, and we ain't got none. What do you think of that?
That is exactly right. The Democrats and the Republicans are essentially two different right wings of one corporate party. Like you put it, they take money from the same donors. Their national committees are both stacked with lobbyists. And so the idea that a committee of corporations is going to represent working people is ludicrous. And not just that, they've gamed the rules internally inside the parties so that it's impossible for working people to really come to power. There are no democratic mechanisms inside the party which enable a takeover. And you can see the consequences of that by the fact that there are only two in the entire 2018 midterms. The Democrats have blocked all but two progressives who have unseated establishment Democrats. And so that's how it's going. Progressives are being blocked in the elections across the board, basically, and within the party organization. And so that's why, really, we need a second party, you know? And so I'm so glad to be joining you and Alan to talk about how it is that we can do that.
Would you comment on the recent Democratic Party convention here this past summer, where, a lot of the press spin and what was that? Oh, they're reforming and they're opening up to Sanders and progressives and so forth. And they've made changes in the superdelegates. From looking afar through the mainstream media, which is kind of an opaque telescope here, it seemed to me that while they made a concession about the superdelegates, who are these corporate lobbyists, by the way, and CEOs, they've made a concession to not have them vote on the first vote for a candidate. But they superdelegates can always vote on the sex, as they always have, to block a progressive candidate on the second vote. Anybody who's been in the union convention knows, almost always the ruling group can block a first vote and then maneuver on the second. But what bothers me more is that, from what I understand from that convention, the chair of the Democratic Party can veto any candidate he doesn't like now. That seems like a step backwards. Can you comment on what happened at the convention?
Yes, they so what you're referring to is the Democratic Party's, the DNC's 2018 summer meeting in Chicago, which they got together, the party got together, the superdelegates, to basically write the rules for the 2020 presidential race. And in doing so, they expanded and consolidated their power to rig the primaries in favor of the establishment in several different ways. One of them is that egregious new rule that is a faithfulness clause that says that the DNC chair alone gets to determine whether a candidate has been sufficiently faithful to the Democratic Party in their career of, everything they've written, everything they've ever said, everything they've ever supported. And if the DNC chair, in this case, Tom Perez, who was entirely against Bernie Sanders in 2016, decides that you're not eligible, he can block you from getting on the ballot in the first place. So essentially, why wait until the primary or the convention to cheat progressives out of the nomination when you can just block them from running in the first place? But that was just one change. There were others. So the much-touted superdelegate change, like you say, first of all, progressives were calling to eliminate superdelegates. What they did instead is they kept them. And like you said, they control the Rules and Bylaws Committee. They have every single member of that 30-person committee, which enables them during the convention to push it to a second ballot should they choose, just like you said, so they can reactivate the superdelegates nonetheless. And also the fact that the superdelegates still exist means that campaigns will have to warp themselves and contort themselves to the establishment's interests, essentially to appealing to these people, like I did. My position on the Bernie Sanders 2016 campaign shouldn't exist. There should be no reason that you have to appeal to superdelegates. Each superdelegate, by the way, has the power of 10,000 mortal voters, typical primary voters who cast their ballot. So you get the ridiculous scenario that a candidate like Hillary Clinton is like 30% of the way to the nomination before a single person has cast a ballot. But it's worse than that, too. Because they also, in 2016, Bernie, he won more than half of the states that he won were caucuses. They were caucus states. They favor insurgent progressive candidates. And so, lo and behold, one of the changes that the party has decided to make for 2020 is to work to eliminate caucuses. And so they're removing each of those. They're also stacking the order of the primaries. So they're shifting around the state in order to favor establishment candidates, which states are going to vote first. So it's and the last thing that I'll mention is that they also kept, in 2016, the Hillary Clinton campaign set up a joint fundraising agreement with the DNC, which secretly gave them control over the DNC, over the Democratic parties, hiring, strategy, communications, press releases. It basically made the DNC a wing of the Clinton campaign. And according to the DNC and the party's own bylaws, the party is supposed to remain neutral in primaries. But of course, they disregard that entirely. Nothing was changed about the joint fundraising agreements either. And so even the way in which they rigged the 2016 primary is still permissible. And so just in every single way, they've expanded and consolidated their power. In 2016, they were kind of caught off guard by Bernie. Now they're very much ready to rig the primaries, as they have been doing in 2018 against congressional and other candidates.
You were on the inside there when it was very clear during 2016 that even before, perhaps, that they were doing everything they could to block and prevent Sanders in every way, shape, and form. You mentioned a few of them. Can you just give our audience a little educational on how they did it, how they stopped Sanders?
Sure. And so the first thing that they did is they rigged the debates. There were many more debates in 2008 than there were in 2016. There were like 26 debates between Obama and Hillary Clinton, and that was reduced to 4 debates before the primaries between Bernie and Clinton. And obviously that was to prevent Bernie from gaining name recognition and exposure and getting his ideas out there. And they also scheduled the debates around holidays and on the weekends and, you know, on the worst possible time. One of them was scheduled, they were scheduled during major football games. You know, one of them was scheduled on the busiest shopping day right before Christmas. So that was the first way. Then they did other things. For example, they shut down the campaign's data access in December of 2015 because they basically held the campaign hostage on that. And so that was all of the voter data that enabled them to contact, to canvas, to phone bank. And so the campaign was basically shut down for days as a result of that. Another thing they did is that, of course, the media coverage was all, you know, the media is complicit in this. And the Hillary Clinton campaign was always constantly planting stories, you know, with the media and suppressing the Sanders campaign. The media gave Donald Trump billions in free coverage. And they would never cover Bernie's rallies. You know, Bernie was rallying tens of thousands of people across the country. They never spoke about it. They also rigged some of the conventions, like the Nevada convention, you know, famously, where they would just basically, because they control the procedural rules, they would shave delegates off of different states, you know, including the caucus states where Bernie was doing well. I personally caught one of the state chairs trying to steal delegates from us, literally miscalculating, warping the delegate math in order to take delegates from us. You know, so it was across the board, the cheating that was happening. And then, of course, you have the underlying factors, which are the fact that the Democratic and Republican parties both are entirely financed by billionaires, corporations, enormous super PACs, and by quid pro quo between corporations. And so through all of those different ways and the superdelegates, they essentially shut down Bernie Sanders' campaign.
Let me ask Alan a question. Alan, why is it, do you think that, you know, if they treated Sanders so shabbily, And they're continuing to rig the game to prevent him again. Why is it that Sanders doesn't seem to break or want to break from the Democratic Party? It seems that they've got this inside-outside strategy, you know, where we're going to orient, he's going to orient to those who voters who no longer believe in the Democratic Party, but he's also going to orient to the left wing of the Democratic Party, although that's an oxymoron, I think. But why is Sanders still linking himself to the Democratic Party?
Well, that's a good question. I think he's basically accepted that that's the framework and the only framework that is reasonably is one that he can make some gains in. I think it's absolutely a wrong approach. But he's bought, I mean, he's made his peace with the establishment. He's become an establishment candidate. He used to be independent. He's, quote, for years caucused with the Democrats. But his decision to run inside the Democratic Party and then to accept, because one of the conditions for him being able to run and get any kind of play at all, even though it was rigged, was that he pledge in advance that he would support the candidate that comes out of the that came out of the convention. And that was, of course, everybody knew it would be Hillary Clinton. She was the anointed one. She was Wall Street's candidate. And by him doing that, I can still see him sitting sheepishly in that Democratic convention listening to Hillary's acceptance speech. It was a sorry spectacle of somebody who'd sold out. I'm going to say it openly. He tied his fate to this establishment party and is misleading people into thinking that this is still a vehicle to make change. And a lot of folks had great illusions, and I was there alongside pushing and saying let's get Bernie embrace, to fight for single-payer health care at the convention. And, of course, that was denied. And so I can't speak to his personal motivation. I was an activist in the Bernie Sanders movement in Vermont when he first emerged, in the early 70s, and have followed his evolution to the right. On foreign policy and other issues. And when I saw that he refused even to meet with Nick and the movement for Draft Bernie for a People's Party, that he wouldn't even meet with them to discuss, you know, it was clear that, you know, he'd made his peace with that wing, that right-wing wing of the corporate party with two heads. So it's unfortunate, but you know what's interesting in all of this, Jack, is that there's a big discussion going on within labor that we have to do something different, and you know we can talk about that in a minute, but it doesn't exactly address your question. But I guess those are my thoughts at this time.
Yeah, we definitely want to come back to that before the end of the show about what's going on in official union ranks here on these questions. I watched and wrote about the 2008 and then 10 and then 12, 14, 16 elections. It seemed to me that, you know, Obama pretty much pulled together a big coalition of people who were very hopeful in 2008, including Latinos and other minorities and union people and youth and so forth. And then, as I wrote in one of my books, he clearly made a conservative right turn as soon as he got into office with his recovery program, which was really pro-business. But then in 2010, when the economy really wasn't growing and he had a choice to really deepen the bailout of Wall Street He turned his back once again and gave business another $800 billion tax cut, which seemed to me, you know, I'm a student of history, exactly opposite of what FDR did. You know, when FDR came in office in 33, he put a pro-business program in, just like Obama did. But then when it wasn't working in 34, he announced and made his move to introduce the New Deal. And the Democrats swamped Congress in the midterm elections. Well, Obama did just the opposite, and the Democrats got swamped in the 2010 election. And then in 2012, Obama asked for one more chance. And if you looked at it, he won in the key states because of the Hispanic and youth and union vote again. You know, they gave him one more chance. And, of course, he still did not deliver. In fact, you know, the most, you know, sending people out of immigrants out of the country. In the history, you know, that was his policy. My question is to you, clearly Hispanics and minorities and youth and unions in key states turned their back on the Democratic Party and Clinton in 2016. And that's how Trump won those swing states. What do you think is going to happen in this very historic midterm election coming up, where we're getting predictions of a blue wave by the same, by the way, those pollsters who totally missed the predictions in 2016. Will, you're very active in the Latino community, Hispanic community. Will they turn out for the Democrats this time? I don't think the youth will, because I know a lot of younger people, you know, and they're kind of even more cynical than ever before. And then I don't know what the union folks are going to do. But what about the Latino folks? Are they going to turn out and vote Democrat? What's your sense?
Just to review a little bit, the vote, the main feature of the Latino vote was abstention, not vote for the Republicans or for the Democrats. They felt betrayed, 3 million people deported, continued attacks that disproportionately affect Latino, Black, and others. I'll take issue a little bit with you on the overemphasis on the question of identity politics. I don't disagree with you on the question of identity politics, but the main victims of these policies, in addition to white workers, are Latino, especially Latino and Black workers. They've and people at every level, their rights, their housing, they're just disproportionately affected in every way. Will they vote? You know, the difficulty of predicting right now is that for many people, Trump is seen as such a threat to our basic democracy that I think you're going to have more people holding their nose than before and voting for a Democrat just to stop this right-wing cabal, this sort of proto-fascism that's setting in. And it's creating a difficulty within the unions. People tell us, we really agree with you. We have to start building the foundations of a new political party, but at the level of federal and governors and Senate and House, you know, we're going to have to stop this, you know, Trump juggernaut. Otherwise, we're dead in the water. And I think it has some, you know, I don't want to exaggerate it, but I think it will have some play. Will it be a blue wave? Probably not. There's probably going to be still a large abstention. Latinos haven't gotten anything from the blues, you know, as you mentioned. The promises on DACA, you know, that was exposed for a lot of the young, especially the young DACA activists. They said, you know, there was going to be a deal, you'll recall, with Pelosi and Schumer. They would pass, they would enact and support DACA. And Trump was going to support it as well, but in exchange, there was going to be more funding for the wall and more restrictive laws on immigrants. And they said, we're not going to sell out our parents. We're not going to sell out those who are fleeing from dictatorships or poverty in the name of giving us some rights. We want rights for all. This is a tremendous, tremendous movement among young people. So I agree with you. The young people aren't buying into it. The young people, they're flocking to organizations like the Democratic Socialists of America. They're looking at this initiative, Labor Community Campaign for Independent Politics. They're looking for alternatives. The sad tragedy is that for most people, that alternative is not visible. That's why we're creating an alternative, so that people have a choice. Faced with a choice, abstaining, possibly leaving the Republicans in control, I think you will have some shift of abstentionists in 2014 and 2016 who will vote Democrat, despite the fact that they don't see any real improvement, but they just want to stop the Trump. I could be wrong. I tend to, just from my experience and from discussing with some of the labor activists and the Latino activists, that's the tendency of what they're talking about.
Well, let me clarify my view on identity politics. Since you brought that up, I think that's the bane of progressive politics in this country. It fragments everybody into single issueism, and what has to happen is all these leaders, real leaders of single issues, have to come together under one umbrella, some kind of party or organization. Or that organization question is the question. Now that doesn't mean by saying that I'm anti-ethnic politics of whether it's Hispanic or African-American or whatever. What that means is that what you've got in Democratic Party and others is to push identity to the exclusion of real economic working class issues. It's a way of crowding out those real issues. You can push real issues and recognize that people have special issues based on race or whatever within them. But the question is, what do you emphasize, and what really aggregates and mobilizes the greatest number of people together? And of course, Latinos and blacks and so forth, they're all working class. There isn't very many professionals, and certainly not executives and managers, very, very few. So by pushing real working class wage issues, you're really pushing ethnic issues as well. As far as the turnout, I'm still pessimistic. I think the liberals, some liberals, intellectuals, and middle class, upper middle class types will be activated by this anti-Trump stuff. But I still think that most working people see this as a pissing match between the elites and what's in it for them. And I guess I'm leaning 60-40 that we're going to have a lot of abstentions here coming up. Anyway, that's my two cents and clarification.
You could be right, Jack. On the issue of identity politics, all I would say is the following. There is no question that a second mass-based party needs to bring together labor and community. It has to be a united working class movement. It's important, however, to acknowledge that they're very specific national, not ethnic, national demands for reparations and others that have not been heeded, and that black militants have put forward over the years, that to win this layer of activists and population who are oppressed by nationality, not just by their class status, it's important to acknowledge these issues, not to bend to them, not to create divisions or sectoralize the work sectoralism or identity politics, I could not agree with you more. It's the bane. It's what's prevented us from being and building a strong united movement. But special recognition has to be made to be able to win folks to the banner of unity and working class unity of the special forms of oppression that Latinos and blacks in particular confront. That's my only disqualification on that. And as far as the vote, you know, I don't doubt that there's going to be continued massive abstention. But even if there is a vote that goes towards the Democrat, it's not a mandate for the Democrats push to the right. It's a protest. It's a form of a protest vote. And I think we'll find a lot of those folks willing to work with us as we build the foundations for a new labor-based political party.
Well, I agree with you about the acknowledgement of the special issues for people of nationalist origin. It's just a question of emphasis and how you put the two kinds of issues together. As I've said, and I'll lead into a question here for you again, Nick, here. The question before us is the organization question. You know, there is no other question. I really believe the conditions are really there and that most people are aware of them. You know, intellectuals go around talking about income inequality. Well, hell, people know that. You know, people know the banks ripped us off. People know that wages have really, really not risen. They know inflation's really higher than it is. They know their retirement has been screwed. They know all this. But, you know, working folks aren't stupid. They're not going to jump off the edge of the cliff unless they see something real organizationally and convincing. And I think you'll get the turnout. You know, we have terrible turnout in this country for voting, but I think you get a massive turnout when people see an organization that really represents and it's viable and it's credible. And that leads me to you, Nick. Why do you think, you know, your movement, your People's Party, is on that track?
Right. So that's why we have now 2 out of every 3 Americans that is calling for a major new party. That's according to Gallup, which tracks the desire for a third party every year. And so it's reached a record high. I completely agree with you that the conditions are there. I saw a poll just now from Pew that showed that the number of people who trust the government to do the right thing always is 3%. The number of people who trust it to do the right thing always or most of the time is 18%. So there's an incredible crash in confidence in institutions, confidence in the party. There's a mass desire for something new. The way that I think of this is that working people find themselves in a burning house. And there's a door to the right and a door to the left. And they are desperate to escape that burning house. And they want to go through the door to the left. But they're at the door, jiggling the handle, and unable to go through because the establishment has blocked that. And when the establishment does block that, as we talked about earlier in the show, then they will take the door to the right. That is how we got Donald Trump. So we saw the consequences of, you remember the hysteria in 2016 about you have to vote against Trump. You know, Donald Trump was a sex offender. That was known, you know, back then. And so we... And the media spent billions, basically, of airtime against him when it came down between him and Hillary. And yet we saw the consequences of that. It was still Trump. And so I agree with you that there is going to be very high abstention, and I don't think that this is going to be as favorable to Democrats as people would like to believe. So the organizational question... In the United States, as Alan could tell you so well, unions are really the base of working class power. And in combination with social movements, that is where you reach the kind of critical mass potential to create a new mass-based party in the United States. And that's what we're doing with the Labor Community Campaign for an Independent Party. which we launched just about a month and a half ago now. And we've made tremendous progress already and had some incredible support. We sent you our endorsers. So we've had Dr. Cornell West join us, Chris Hedges, Valdemar Velasquez, head of the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, endorsing as an individual, Nancy Woolforth, who is the head of Pride at Work at the AFL-CIO. We've had tremendous labor endorsers. Jimmy Dore, who many who listen to your show may be familiar with as well, one of the most popular progressive commentators in the country. And so that's the kind of coalition that we need to build, a coalition that brings together labor unions and brings together social movements, because that's where you get that explosive potential to really fulfill the mandate that working people are giving us now, 2 out of 3 wanting a major new party. And also, I should say, because people ask, well, what's the character of that new party? You go down the issue polls one by one, 70% in favor of Medicare for all, 62% in favor of free public college, 90% in favor of getting money out of politics. You know, majorities, 60% or above, in favor of breaking up the big banks, reducing inequality. And so this is the mandate that working people are giving us. When you combine that, it is essentially a new party of the left that the Democratic Party is now in, but ideologically completely unrepresentative of. And so that's what we have the chance to create. That's what we've begun assembling the coalition for.
Where can people go to find out more information, join this movement for a new party or whatever? This is very important. Listeners need to know where they can go, because it's time to stop talking and doing. Start doing something. Get off your butts. Okay, tell the folks where they can go, Nick.
You can find more information about this at The Organizer, and Alan can share that more about that as well. You can also find us at For a People's Party, and that's spelled out, foraPeople'sParty.org. And you can find our announcements that we've made there. You can find the sign up for the Labor Community Campaign there as well. And then you can also email us at labor.communitycampaign@gmail.com in order to get involved. And so now we're building the coalition with grassroots supporters. We have more than 600 people who have signed up to help build a labor community campaign coalition in their city. And so that is where we're going next, because that's how I think you can build the groundwork, is by building labor community assemblies that begin to elect independent candidates, that pick them from within the community, really well-rooted candidates who are representative. And so you can go there and sign up, and Alan can tell you more about the organizer.
Alan, that's a good segue back to you. Can you tell us more? And then, Alan, I want you to tell us what's going on in labor circles, AFL-CIO, and whether labor will, at the local level, I don't believe these guys at the head in Washington are going to ever break from the Democratic Party, but that doesn't mean that more progressive, real people and at the local union level won't. Can you segue into that? But first, tell us more about where people can go and what's being done.
Yeah, well, this is a coalition effort, a Movement for People's Party, Socialist Organizer, and many other organizations are now jumping on board, which is wonderful, endorsing and saying we want to build these labor community coalitions locally, run candidates, and begin the discussion in the labor movement at all levels, but beginning from the rank and file to take this new project forward. Socialistorganizer.com is a website where, together with the For a People's Party, you can find information, a lot of the background discussion, particularly as it concerns the labor movement and the debates and the discussions in the labor movement. We're really emphasizing this aspect from our contribution to this coalition. As far as labor, One thing that struck me looking at the more than 500, now close to 600 endorsers, is the large number of union activists and even rank and file or middle layer local level union officials. This is very important. It was at this level that the big upsurge began with the teachers in West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Arizona. These were local union officials, not the top union officials in their states, local shop stewards, local elected delegates, who said, we've got to move this thing and let the leaders follow or else get out of the way. And that's what you're seeing here. I think that it's important to note, though, that there is a discussion that's taking place at higher levels of the labor movement, which I think is a reflection of this anger simmering from below, which is, I think, Nick's imagery of the burning house. People know that they've been so betrayed time and again by the Democrats that we need something different. And that was expressed, if only to contain it, at the AFL-CIO convention last October, where two resolutions were passed, one calling for a break with the two lesser of two evil politics, or underscoring the fact that with the two corporate parties, working people always get shafted. That opens a discussion at all levels. So we're anxious to promote, especially from below in the unions, but also get a buy-in from some of the top leaders. Baldemar Velasquez, we're hoping that Mark Dimenstein, president, a rank-and-file activist who won the presidency of the American Postal Workers Union and who's been on picket lines, who's been and is a militant. People from some of these other unions, nurses and others who have been talking about breaking and working independently. We don't want to go down the road of the Labor Party in the 1990s, where the top leaders were able to turn off the movement when they thought that it was getting out of their control. It has to be controlled from below. There has to be accountability. There has to be labor and community involvement so that it's not just simply labor and labor officials. So we've learned a lot of the lessons. We're discussing some of these lessons in our paper as part of the work that we're doing collectively. It's really wonderful. It's just brilliant being able to work with Nick and the Movement for a People's Party. Please join us all in this effort. You know, learn about us all. This is, I think, one of the most exciting projects and campaigns that's come along in the past 25 years. I think it has that potential to really lay the foundation for a mass-based working-class party.
I've observed that in California, in particular, there seems to be bubbling at the city-local levels, groups coming together and forming progressive alliances. You know, we've had that in Richmond here in California, and they made some great gains fighting even Chevron, nonetheless, for their city, some tremendous gains. These were people who weren't in the Democratic Party, and they were able to do it. But now I'm hearing, and people are even asking me to come and support them with presentations and talking and so forth, which I'm glad to do. Rent control movements, and so forth. And I understand that there's a California Progressive Alliance convention coming up early next year. My question to you and Nick is: do you see this, geographic city level development as something that might become part of your coalition as well? And are you guys doing anything to link up with them?
Take it away, Nick.
Yes. And so Gail McLaughlin, who was one of the co-founders of the Richmond Progressive Alliance and also the California Progressive Alliance now, the ones you're referring to, she was at our first labor forum, actually, in San Francisco. that she spoke there. And so it's definitely something that we want to work with. It's a similar effort, although the Labor Community Campaign for an Independent Party, what we're working on is something that is explicitly independent from the Democratic Party, you know, and we're explicitly advocating a clean break from the corporate parties, because there's no such thing as politics that represents working people when it is driven by a committee of corporations and financed by corporations and billionaires. And I'll also say that the only thing that I think, as we're witnessing in some other countries like Italy, Brazil, most recently, the only thing that can prevent a right wing, a far right takeover, as we see with Bolsonaro, poised to almost certainly win the election in Brazil, is a left alternative. As people lose confidence in an establishment that has betrayed them year after year, decade after decade, then they get they become desperate as the house catches, as more of the house catches on fire. And the only thing that can prevent that decline into authoritarianism, which you see in many of these countries and which you see in the United States, albeit at an earlier stage, is the emergence of a genuine left alternative. And so in that conversation about how is it that we, you know, how is it that we stop Donald Trump? How is it that we stop the far right in the United States? Then you have to go back to the source, and you have to say, how is it that these movements emerged? How is it that they were allowed to take hold? How is it that Donald Trump was able to win in the first place? And it is the fact that when confronted with the choice between the far right and the status quo establishment, Hillary Clinton, embodied by Hillary Clinton in 2016, people will consistently choose the escape hatch, even if it is to the right. And so that's the real imperative around doing this. There's no way to get around it. There's temptation to think that first we need to triage by electing the lesser evil, which would be the Democrats, in an effort to try to stop Trump and the devastation that he's wreaking. But that's exactly the kind of thinking and the kind of action that gave us Donald Trump in the first place. And so what we need instead is that genuine alternative that the large majority of people are demanding now. That is, I sometimes think that intellectuals and progressives overcomplicate things, and they do a lot of hand-wringing. In truth, working people are telling us by an overwhelming majority, that two-thirds majority, what it is that will inspire them back into politics and what it is that will inspire them to commit themselves to a different kind of politics. And that is the emergence of a major new party, the one that they're demanding.
Well, you know, your metaphor about the burning house is right on. And what you're really describing when you talk about offshore is also accurate, in that we're seeing the collapse of these social democratic parties worldwide. And the Democratic Party used to be sort of social democrat-like before the DNC took it over, or DLC rather. That's happening everywhere. So we got a burning house everywhere, not just in the U.S. It's a global phenomenon. And until there's an alternative, as you say, out of desperation, they've got most folks have nowhere to turn. If anything, you know, they vote for the Trumps to stick a thumb in the eye of the elites that are failing to deliver for them, full knowing, I think, in many cases, these right wing Trump like alternatives will deliver. And, you know, the problem with the Democratic Party is that they're just not able to stop Trump. They're not able to stop Trump. Jack, restore the economy from the crisis and crash of 2008-9. And tactically, and strategically they are inept. And I think that's the biggest criticism one could make of them. They can't deliver anymore. There's no alternative except to form a new organizational alternative. At least that's my particular view in this regard. Comment?
Jack, if I may, I don't think it's just that they're inept and that they can't fight Trump. I think, as Nick pointed out, they're responsible for Trump. It's their failure of 8 years in office to provide any kind of improvement in the living conditions of the working class who saw their factories be offshored by NAFTA. It was Trump who was the one who at least gave voice to their plight and said, you know, this is a rotten deal. It was a right-wing answer to the problem when the so-called left, the Democratic Party, all they could do was just simply deliver those attacks. So they're responsible. They're the ones who brought, and they're not going to provide the answers and solutions. The crisis of the capitalist system today is such that there's no more room for the crumbs off the table that they were able to provide workers and say, well, at least you're getting something. At least there's a little bit of an improvement. You're getting your 2% wage increase. There hasn't been that for 25 years, 30 years. And so the only alternative that people see is this right wing, this demagogy, the Bolsonaro, the Le Pen, these phenomenon, because the traditional parties of the workers, working class, even the social democratic parties and others, have become the instruments of the attacks on working people. So we don't, you know, the clock is ticking here. We don't have that much time in this country to create an alternative, because the pendulum is going to move. Whatever happens this election, the pendulum is going to continue to move further and further to the right with the erosion of democratic rights and gains. So we need to wake up to this fact and begin to really, all of us and all your listeners, join in this movement for a new independent party of working people, for working people, rooted in the unions and the youth and the communities of the oppressed. So I thank you for your support, and, you know, hope that you will continue to plug this effort on your shows.
Well, we certainly will, because this is the issue. You know, I think we're going to have a big shocker here in the post midterm elections, maybe on the same scale as the shock when Trump won. You know, the media said 87% Hillary was going to win. And now that same media saying, oh, 84% of the Democrat blue wave is going to happen. I'm not convinced. And I think there's going to be a shocker because, as I've recently written, if you watch what's happening on the right at the grassroots, they are preparing to mobilize their ultra-right troops here. And we may see a shift of them coming out in the streets and actually attacking the demonstrators who are criticizing and protesting against Trump and his policies and the loss of democratic rights and the treatment of immigrant kids coming to this country, putting them in incarceration without their parents. I mean, you know, this is the drift that's occurring. And I agree with you. This isn't going to stop. And it's going to, the pendulum is going to swing faster here, and the Democrats aren't going to stop it. Even if they win a few seats in November, watch them. They're going to talk and talk about impeachment and not get it out of committee or do anything because they have no intention of going after Donald Trump. They think that, well, we'll use Donald Trump for 2020 and get ourselves elected again. They're going to be surprised again, I believe. We have to build a grassroots alternative, and the real leaders, the real movements have to realize they have to come together. There has to be a kind of founding convention before 2020 for a new party. Okay, thank you, both of you. Great guests, and we'll have you on again after the election. How about that?
Great to be on, Jack.
Thank you.
Sounds like a plan.